And welcome to our policy and practice seminar this evening. You will notice that I'm not Professor Adnan Khan, who is unfortunately delayed but will be joining us shortly. But rather than keep you and our speaker waiting any longer, we thought we'd get started. So we're delighted to welcome Marcela Melendez, who's Chief Economist for the UN's Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean. We've sent you all her full biography, so you all know a bit about her already. We're delighted to welcome her this evening to talk to you. I know she's going to make some initial remarks, tell you a little bit about herself, and then we can have a discussion with her, and you can obviously ask your questions. So Marcela, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Apologies that Adnan isn't here yet. But please, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jemima. I'm happy to be here. I will start, and you let me know if this is the usual format of how these works. First, small correction. I am the UNDP chief economist for Latin America and the Caribbean. UNDP is the United Nations Development Program. UN is a huge organization, and the Economic Commission is something different. It's associated to the Secretariat, and it's something different than UNDP. UNDP is the agency in charge of economic development, and it's a kind of an umbrella agency in that sense. No, it's like not it covers more broader issues than some other agencies that are specifically looking at labor markets or at education. We are a broader agency in terms of the scope of our interest. I am a Colombian economist. I joined UNDP recently, only a little more than 2 years ago. I did my undergraduate studies in Colombia at Universidad de los Andes, and I have a PhD in economics from Yale University. I am an applied microeconomist, and I've had a career working in the design and evaluation of public policy, and with a particular interest in issues related to competition policy and regulation. Before joining UNDP, I had a private practice. It was a small boutique firm called Econ Estudio in Bogota. That is a firm where we did both consulting and research on issues related to public policy. It was an interesting place that gave me a standing good enough to participate in important public policy debates in Colombia. I co-directed a mission on equity and social mobility for the government of Colombia. I've been a member of several government commissions of experts on different topics related to the issues on which I worked, and my image just froze, so I don't know if you're seeing me or only listening to me, it's back. And at UNDP, I lead the team that is in charge of, we say, production of knowledge to help policymaking decisions in the countries where we are at. UNDP has offices. It's, I think, probably the multilateral organization that has more physical presence on the territory. We're present in around 26 and countries and 36 or more territories, because some offices cover more than one country, particularly in the Caribbean. My most recent work is the production of the UNDP Regional Human Development Report that was launched recently in June of this year. And I am currently traveling through Europe, actually presenting for the first time in some places in person this report, and trying to continue to deepen, to build on the messages of that report. The report is called Trapped: High Inequality and Low Productivity in Latin American and the Caribbean. I don't know if you would like me to speak a little bit about that, or if you want to ask any questions before that. I am a little bit lost in terms of how the format works. I'd love to tell you a little bit about that report and the big messages that it brings to the table as a sort of an invitation for you to use it and consult it and like participate in the conversations that it proposes, that are conversations that we think are key for development of the Latin American and Caribbean region.
Thank you very much, Marcela, for that introduction. Can some of the students turn on your cameras so Marcela can see you all? make her feel less like she's talking into a void. And if anybody's got any initial questions, then it would be, you know, do fire away. You can put up your electronic hand or just start speaking.
Hi, thank you. I actually had prepared a brief presentation. If you'd rather see it, you want me to show it a little bit and walk you a little bit through the messages of the report?
Yeah, why don't we do that? And hopefully that'll prompt some questions.
I think that's a good idea. Give me 10 seconds. Right. And we'll do that. I'm not allowed to share my screen. So I need permission.
Please. Sorry, let me make you co-host. There we go.
Okay. So our regional human development report proposes that the Latin American and Caribbean region is in a high inequality, low growth trap. We sustain that high inequality and low growth are two phenomena that are interconnected. They are not independent, and that there are common factors that are making us both be highly unequal and grow poorly. These are factors that, if we were able to properly approach, could move the region in the proper direction on both fronts, reducing inequality and improving productivity dynamics and economic growth. The report cannot address all of these factors, but we focus on three of them that are factors that are characterizing of the region: the concentration of power, violence, and social protection systems that do not work well. We look at perceptions of inequality as a factor that may be contributing to the trap, in as much as how people perceive inequality in their societies and how they perceive themselves on, along the income distribution, determine people's positions towards redistributive policies. For instance, they determine how people who they think should pay taxes and who should receive government subsidies. I am not going to present the whole report or the messages, but I am going to focus this presentation on the third of these factors: social protection systems that do not work well, to see if I can tease you into looking into the report. This is chapter 5 of the report, and it builds on specific detailed studies for 10 countries in the region. We have continued to work on these, and we are expanding the number of countries that we are studying deeply with a common methodology and a common view. So what I'm going to discuss with you, try to show you, is the main messages of that chapter. Labor markets in Latin America are characterized by very high labor informality. What we call informality in this case is the lack of affiliation to a contributory social insurance system. Large shares of the labor force in Latin America and the Caribbean are excluded from the main social protection programs associated to contributory social insurance. These are the type of programs that protect people from the risks that we all face: health risks, longevity, discapacity, unemployment. You see in the table that we have, these are the set of 10 countries that we studied in depth. And we see that while informality levels vary across countries, they are very, very high in many of them. In Honduras, 82% of the working force is not covered by a social insurance program that is contributory, for instance. We also see that workers in the in informality are not exactly the same as workers in poverty. So while there is a high correlation between informality and poverty, there is a share there of informal workers that are not poor and that matters for public policy design. The formal-informal segmentation of the labor force in Latin America is, of course, partly the result of non-compliance by firms and workers with their obligations to participate in contributory social insurance systems. But what we find when we look at countries is that there are issues of design in terms of the regulatory framework that are excluding part of the working population from these programs. What we see in this slide is an example from Colombia. These are the rules that the outcome on the right hand, the panel on the right hand side, is the outcome of the rules for independent workers' affiliation to contributory social insurance systems. And what happens here is that the system fails to recognize the fact that the minimum wage in Colombia is set in a very strange way, so that it doesn't really operate as a minimum, but rather is like it stands sort of like in the middle of the labor income distribution. That's the left-hand side graph. In Colombia, around 50% of the workforce earns less than the minimum wage. And the legal framework establishes that in order to be able to contribute, workers must contribute having the minimum wage as the base for contributions. This means that workers earning less than the minimum wage will end up having to contribute up to, and maybe even more than two-thirds of their income in order to participate. So the result is this very regressive shape in which workers with higher income would end up contributing much less of as a share of their income than the poorest workers. The result is, of course, that the poorest workers just do not contribute because, in a sense, the system taxes their decision to become formal, or you could say subsidizes their decision to remain in informality. So this is a big issue, and this is just one example of the type of legal exclusions that are making the labor force highly informal. Because governments know this, they know that they are excluding a large shares of the population from coverage under contributory systems, they have responded by creating parallel non-contributory social insurance systems that usually provide lower quality services. And these programs meant to protect informal workers and their families coexist with social assistance programs that are meant for poverty reduction. This matters because both types of programs, social insurance programs and social assistance programs, should be the two pillars that compose a proper working social protection system. In settings where the design is correctly done, social insurance and social assistance that comprehends all of the programs meant for poverty reduction are complements and not substitutes. And should coexist in a way that that doesn't distort decisions of workers and firms. Social insurance, as I said before, is meant to protect workers from risks that everyone faces. They are not meant to mitigate poverty. And social assistance programs are those that are for poverty alleviation and usually take the shape of transfers, conditional or unconditional. In the end, this little table, this little figure that we have here should include all of the employed workforce. We would want everyone to end up in the first quadrant where workers are formal and non-poor. And we very often have people concentrated on the in quadrants 2 and 4 with high informality. One thing that is important and that I said before is that informality is not a synonymous of poor, not necessarily in our countries. Our social protection systems are designed in a way that proved to be very fragile, very weak, when we had to respond to the crisis brought about by the COVID pandemic. In advanced economies, there were systems that had unemployment insurance. There was a coverage of social health insurance for most of the population. This didn't happen in our countries. And when people from one day to the next lost their income, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how that came about in Latin America, the tool that we had to respond was basically the programs that belong to the in the social assistance pillar. We had transfers programs. And we, our countries made great efforts using whatever they had at hand. They created some new transfer programs, they expanded others and adapted programs that they already had. But the problem with transfers programs is that they basically, because they were conceived to mitigate poverty, they didn't have people listed. Informality means invisibility. That's one of the byproducts. Informal workers are invisible to governments. So we had social registries in some countries better than others, but these social registries not necessarily included all those that lost their jobs or their incomes from one day to the next. As a result, the response has been insufficient to contain the fall into poverty. Some countries had like an overshooting, in particular, Brazil and Chile did well. Brazil allowed people to self-select in order to be able to receive transfers. And this implied that in the beginning, it reduced the poverty rate even below its level before the pandemic. That like can be questioned as probably not fiscally sustainable in the long term, but that was an exception. One of the messages that we give in the report is that the region cannot expect transfer programs on their own to reduce poverty. Transfer programs in the end, if properly set, should provide a network to protect those families that are left vulnerable to poverty or left in poverty after other social policies are in place. We have contributory social insurance systems that have very low coverage, and that's part of the problem. But the other problem that we have is that in the way they are set up, our contributory social insurance systems fail to provide insurance even of those workers that contribute to the social insurance system, paying a share of their salaries. And this happens because we've again failed to recognize the way in which our labor markets are organized. So in reality, in Latin America, there is no such thing as a formal or informal worker. Rather, workers transit many times throughout their work lives between formality and informality. Here we have some examples from a few countries where we were able to access registries from the social insurance systems. And you see that the diagonals are always below 100. So what we see is that people that start in one year being formal, the next year in a large percentage may fall into informality or disappear. The implication from these transitions is that getting a pension from a contributory system becomes very hard. People that a majority of people or large shares of people are unable to comply with the time they are supposed, with the weeks they are supposed to be contributing. They are not able to complete the savings that would be required in order to get that contributory pension. So they end up arriving at old age without any protection. In many of our countries, when they when the time, their age or the weeks are completed and not all the requirements are met in order to get a contributory pension, people receive their money back in some countries even without interest, and in some countries they don't get it back. So they lose their savings. What is more painful here is that those who are the richest contributions along their work life. So on average, people, a small share of people actually gets a contributory pension, but those who are on the upper side of the labor income distribution have a higher probability to get a contributory pension than the lower. And when they do, in our countries in Latin America, they not only get their pensions, but they usually get high subsidies from general taxation, because the parameters of the pension systems are set up in a way that they wouldn't be enough on their own to provide the pensions at the levels that they actually provide to those that end up complying and being able to pension. So this is a very painful story that tells us that we have built two parallel systems in most countries. This is a story that we have, like, we have been doing copy paste from one country to the next in terms of the mistakes that we make. And we end up not even being able to provide enough protection to people who are in the contributory system. There is a lot of like failure in terms of policies. I'm coming from not understanding the workings of the of like how our labor markets are set up in reality. Another message that we try to give very strongly in the report is the fact that social protection outcomes in the end depend on what firms do. And firms' behavior depends on social protection policies and labor market regulations, among other regulations. So firms maximize their profits and they internalize whatever regulations they are put forth, including regulations from the social, like from the setup of social protection systems and social assistance systems. What we find is that the interaction between social insurance, social assistance, and special tax regimes in Latin America and the Caribbean represent implicit subsidies to operate in informality and implicit taxes for formal works. The interaction, this is just what I said, and I had some examples here just to leave with you. I'm not going to go over them, but just to give you an example. For instance, the concern to have informal workers not covered by health insurance has meant that many countries have put together non-contributory health systems, very often of lower quality than those that may be accessed by workers covered under contributory programs, but still there is coverage. And this is a type of coverage that workers can have even if they don't contribute to or don't pay any insurance and if they don't save for old age. Because workers tend to, like, and I guess all of us, tend to look at the present and discount the future a lot. We do not worry about what will happen in old age when we're younger. There is a very high incentive to not contribute at all if you have your health covered, which is something that is more immediate to workers and their needs in the present. Part of the result of these interactions of the regulatory setup is the fact that our workforce is organized in a very atypical way compared to advanced economies in terms of the large share of workers that are in self-employment or that work in tiny firms. Here you have the story of the US in the right end of the graph, and you can compare it with the rest of the Latin American countries. Informality is strongly associated with self-employment and employment in small low productivity businesses. And this is a critical determinant of worker earnings and long-term productivity. We are making the argument that one of the causes of this atypical way in which work and businesses are organized in terms of sizes and in terms of self-employment is a response to the setup of regulation and to the way our social protection systems are conceived. And we are connecting this with economic growth because a large part of productivity improvement is associated to the way we get trained when we are already working, which is very different than when we work completely alone or in very tiny businesses where there is no product opportunity for training. So workers that work on their own, that are not very educated, and or that work with very few people, like in very small family businesses, are condemned to low productivity and low income. And of course, this not only hurts them, but also hurts the whole society in the sense of affecting economic growth. This is just to convince you that there is a high correlation between the distribution of personal income and the distribution of business sizes. This table shows the Latin American population by income quintiles and the way each quintile is spread between self-employment and different firm sizes. So we see that people in the lowest 20% are highly concentrated in self-employment and employed in tiny firms. And people in the upper end of the distribution tend to be more employed in what we are calling non-microfirms, firms that are firms of 10 or more employees. So these are even small firms by international comparison. Let me make a point before I go on. There is what we are finding is that the distribution of personal income in Latin America and the Caribbean has a mirror in the distribution of firm sizes and self-employment. And we are saying this is both a source of inequality and a source of low productivity and low growth. So in a sense, this challenges what we have been taught about the competing avenues of increasing efficiency and increasing equality. This is a setup in which this type of trade-off that we would have between becoming more equal or growing better, it fails to apply because our countries are at a different stage level in the sense that they are not yet there. So we are in a world where policies that would improve productivity can also contribute to improve equity and to make us more equal. Looking forward, our report is making a strong case about transiting towards universality in social insurance system. And we are understanding universality as everyone exposed to a given risk covered by the same program, the same source of financing for each program so that the financing of these systems stops being based on worker status, but is rather covered with general taxation, and we would insist that in-kind benefits be of the same quality for all, and not like we have now, where the poor workers and their families have benefits that are of lower quality. A starting point is, of course, eliminating discontinuities in regulation that tax formality and business growth. For instance, the use of the minimum salaries as thresholds measures, unit measures, in order to decide who participates and who doesn't in different programs from the social protection system. The big challenge that we face looking at the future is that, of course, transiting towards universality requires money, requires tax reforms that will accompany that transit. And this means that at any transit will have to be gradual, and that we need to think it in the particular context of each country. This is sort of the conversation that we give in the report. And let me close before opening the conversation by arguing the following. We have done a lot of copy-pasting, I would keep saying it that way, but between what works and what has been learned for advanced economies and what can be applied and what actually responds to a different reality in our countries. So I just spoke about the trade-off between efficiency and equity, which is not so clear when you look at Latin America and the Caribbean. But there are two other examples. One of them related to this strange way in which the work is distributed among firm sizes and self-employment. Just recently, there's been an ongoing global conversation where Europe and the United States is very concerned about how markets are becoming more concentrated and how giant firms are taking over